Hello, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Welcome to Lungcast. Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or better known as COPD, currently exists in a unique space among our country's healthcare burdens. It has been on a decade-long climb in new annual cases and remains among the most persistent diseases through the tobacco belt of the Midwest. Relative to the observed rate of impaired lung function in United States patients, it is grossly underdiagnosed. Even diagnoses vary on a spectrum, from standard COPD to overlap emphysema, chronic bronchitis, and in cases, severe forms of asthma. And despite the significant presence, the diversity of COPD presentation, and the continued toll the chronic respiratory disease has on Americans, treatment options are limited and the current ceiling for improvement is low. But breakthrough wins may still be possible. This month's episode of Lungcast features Dr. Gerard Criner, Chair and Professor of Thoracic Medicine and Surgery at the Lewis Katz School of Medicine at Temple University, as well as the director of the Temple Lung Center. Dr. Criner lent us his decades worth of expertise and experience in guiding the research and management of advanced lung diseases, including COPD, to help better understand the current state of affairs. He also discussed the most promising means of advancement being considered in therapeutic and diagnostic research. It's a dynamic conversation on a burdensome issue in respiratory care in this newest episode of Lungcast. So, Dr. Criner, you've hosted yearly updates to the management of COPD recommended by the GOLD initiative, and you're also part of the committee that recommends updates from the American Thoracic Society. For our listeners, can you summarize some of the key highlights that have come out over the last couple of years that you feel can have the greatest impact on the care of these patients?
Yeah, thanks. I think both societies have worked at very hard on taking their more recent results of randomized clinical trials and try to distill them down into the essential points that are needed for improving the care of patients with COPD. I think some commonalities between both ATS as well as GOLD updates are the use of inhaled corticosteroids in the treatment of patients with COPD, especially the patient group that experiences exacerbations, and really the use of long-acting bronchodilators in patients that remain symptomatic despite the use of short-acting bronchodilators. I think the more recent updates that have been done by the GOLD is basically looking at the more recent large clinical trials that show an indication that in a select patient group of patients with COPD who remain highly symptomatic and are exacerbation prone, the value of triple inhaled therapy to improve survival. I think probably those results are the most important for us to care for patients with COPD in the pharmacologic management. The other advantage is the use of peripheral blood eosinophils as a biomarker in patients who may benefit from inhaled corticosteroids to prevent exacerbations for that group. A couple other things that have been important for both societies is a recognition of the value of lung cancer screening in all patients who meet criteria based on general population studies, but really reinterpreting those results for the patient group with COPD, how they should be looked at as well, and probably even more importantly, although the data doesn't show that as yet, for their propensity for lung cancer and the appropriate management for them, since it's a little bit more challenging both in the diagnostic approach as well as the treatment approach in patients with underlying COPD or emphysema.
Good. I understand that one specific or a couple specific treatment modalities that are mentioned in these recommendations, I know have had some ups and downs over the years, has to do with the role of the PDE4 inhibitors and also the use of chronic antibiotic therapy. That's kind of come and gone over the years, but I think recently it's being recommended. Can you touch on those specifically, the pros and cons of those two therapies in this patient population?
Yeah, I think what you're alluding to are patients that are on inhaled respiratory treatments, either with dual bronchodilators or triple therapy with using dual bronchodilators and inhaled steroid, who still has exacerbations. And in those patient groups, chronic macrolide therapy is azithromycin predominantly, but other agents in that group or roflumilast might be indicated. There are some nuances in review of the post-hoc studies that affect those recommendations. In patients that are current smokers, the use of a macrolide doesn't seem to be as effective. However, with roflumilast, it appears to be most effective in the patient group that has chronic bronchitis. So there is nuances, there's drug interactions with both of those, and there's patient tolerance features that might make one agent preferred over the other in an individual patient. But the group of patients who may benefit the most from consideration of those therapies are patients who still have exacerbation despite the use of triple inhaled therapy. One other agent that should be, I think, thought of in this group is the use of theophylline, for which more recent large randomized controlled trials show no benefit to use of theophylline for exacerbation prevention in patient groups with COPD. So I think that's the one who the group class of drugs has shown the least benefit from the most recent clinical trials, whereas roflumilast and azithromycin do have benefit in select patient groups.
Thank you. I know another area of COPD that you're definitely involved with, especially the advanced COPD patient, has to do with the development of some of the non-surgical volume reduction techniques. Can you tell us a little bit about why some patients are good for this, and what are some of the hurdles or barriers that patients may encounter when being trying to be identified for such techniques?
Yeah, so one of the most devastating consequences of patients having COPD, which affects most patients, are hyperinflation, for which our pharmacologic treatments have some effectiveness. But in the patient group who predominantly have an emphysematous phenotype, they're much less effective in creating lung deflation and improving patients' outcome. In that patient group, lung volume reduction surgery, for decades has shown benefit for patients that have severe hyperinflation, but it's underutilized as a tool for reasons that aren't exactly clear, but it's probably related to the connotation of morbidity that surgical approaches may have and somewhat complex sort of workup for these patients. But these less invasive trials with mainly using endobronchial valves, that's the only FDA-approved therapy, has shown comparable success in improving patient outcome compared to lung volume reduction surgery in appropriate selected patients. And that is the first therapy endoscopically that's ever been approved to show that it can improve patients' outcome. And it's equivalent to lung volume reduction surgery when you look at patients with less morbidity. The problem with that therapy, although successful, is it only is effective in about 30% of the patient group that has emphysema because of the requisite to have complete fissures or lack of collateral ventilation. It's that area, the patients who are CV positive or don't have intact fissures, that's the challenge. And there are several new therapies that are being looked at to treat that patient group. And I think overall, the entry of endobronchial valves being approved therapy increases the scope of interventional pulmonology as a viable treatment pathway to complement what we do pharmacologically and non-pharmacologically as yet to improve the treatments that we have for patients with COPD. And there are several other therapies being looked at in that realm right now: use of targeted lung denervation, use of rhenoplasty and metered nitrogen cryospray to treat chronic bronchitis in this patient group. And there's some others that are coming down the pike that I think offer the opportunity that we're just at the beginning of interventional pulmonology to be a viable option for patients with a variety of different phenotypes with COPD emphysema.
Sounds like some exciting future options here for patients. Are some of these techniques considered possible bridges to transplant in certain populations of patients?
They are. I mean, it's a mixture. In some patients, it's destination therapy. Others, it's a bridge to something else, whether it's lung volume reduction surgery or it's lung transplantation. And then I see some therapies probably having sequential overlap in the future, since some patients who have chronic chronic mucus hypersecretion and also have emphysema, whether it's collateral ventilation positive or negative, they might go through the pathway to treat the chronic bronchitis first, then move on and treat the emphysema in some fashion. So I think in the future, maybe 5-10 years from now, we'll have a variety of pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic therapy that we use in combination or in sequence to better manage patients.
So I know you do a lot of research at Temple, but you're also part of our American Lung Association's Airways Clinical Research Network. Can you tell us a little bit about Temple's role in there and some of the studies you're participating in through that affiliation?
So the ALA Clinical Research Network is novel in a sense. It does practical and pragmatic studies before that became a vogue over the last several decades, really looking at common management problems that clinicians and patients face each day, such as the right bronchodilator to use in patients with asthma, the importance of optimum weight control and reconditioning in patients with asthma or COPD, or the use of therapies such as Losartan, which is a blood pressure medication, may have a role as a pathway to prevent early or emphysema progression. So really practical treatments used in patients with a range of airways disease from asthma to COPD or emphysema. And I think one of the more recent efforts, which you've been involved with, is trying to understand better what are the drivers of optimum lung health in the formative stage, in early adulthood, the lung health cohort study, which hopes to be mirror what we found from the Framingham study decades ago with blood pressure and heart disease in Framingham. So, it's really a diversified portfolio that they've had in really tackling important problems that fall out of the normal purview of what either industry conducted research or what the NIH does.
Yeah, I guess in growing out of that lung health cohort study that you mentioned has been our work around lung cancer screening. And I know you were part of a workshop, an ongoing workshop that we held last year, looking at what role the identification of emphysema on patients who get screened for lung cancer may have in an early identification of a disease process that might allow modification of disease or intervention. Can you just touch a little bit on your thoughts about the role of identifying that emphysema on these potentially asymptomatic patients who get screened for lung cancer?
Yeah, I think it's probably, if you're coordinated, it's the lowest of all low-hanging fruit. I mean, the patients have shared risk factors who undergo lung cancer screening with COPD and emphysema. And both diseases are similar in the sense that they're under-recognized and therefore under-treated before a stage where they become more advanced. And lung cancer screening allows an opportunity to screen patients and identify either symptoms, physiologic function, or lung structural abnormalities that may indicate the presence of COPD when patients are experiencing symptoms or near to experience symptoms that don't know what disease that they have and therefore they're undertreated. And some of the studies that have combined COPD detection with lung cancer screening programs have found about 50 to 60% of those patients have COPD, and about half of those that are identified have been undetected to date. Even in some cases, 15% of patients with severe disease. So I think it's a good opportunity to try to improve the detection of two common diseases and do something about it at a stage to improve patients' outcome.
Yeah, as one of the main academic centers, medical centers in Philadelphia, you're right in the heart of the metropolis of that area, and you and your colleagues have witnessed firsthand the challenges of caring for the COVID-19 patients. As a research center, you've been observing and reporting on some of the care that's been given and some of the things that we're learning about COVID-19. Can you just address some of that, of what's happened over the last 2 years with regard to the pandemic and how you've managed it as a research center like Temple?
Yeah, well, I think as you're well aware that Philadelphia hasn't been spared by COVID, and Temple has had about 40, 50% of the COVID treatment in Philadelphia. So unfortunately, our experience is more than I think what we want, especially for patients that are fragile and at-risk minority patients, as well as those who are heavily immune suppressed because of either cancer treatment or transplantation. patient. One of the advantages that we had early on in the pandemic is that we've trained a couple of colleagues in Southeast Asia who were experiencing it first and gave us some guidance early on about what they encountered that worked and didn't work, from diagnostic to treatment paradigms. And we started to implement them based on their recommendation early on. And the things that we found in the non-pharmacologic treatments of COVID was the importance of segregation and early detection using imaging. And we still use that to date, the value of using CT scan imaging to basically identify and quantitate the burden of disease, the detection of a VTE early on in the stage of the disease before it became more commonplace to fully anticoagulate people with mild to moderate disease, and also the use of less invasive strategies to handle respiratory failure. Beginning phases, you recall, it was recommended to basically low threshold for intubation and avoid high flow and non-invasive ventilation. So we, in the beginning, used high flow as our workhorse and published on that the value in the use of non-invasive ventilation with trying to avoid endotracheal intubation. And then we had a large clinical research network, our network that we have. We really made that coincide with our clinical care plan. And we evaluated, and still do each day, every patient that's admitted, both in and outpatient care, for participation in a clinical research trial. So we've been involved in all the antiviral treatments as well as all the anti-cytokine treatments. And to be honest, they have made a difference now handling the Omicron pandemic with using the approved therapies for both of those large, well, I guess the three-pronged approach with using anticoagulant therapy, anti-inflammatory, and antiviral therapy in part of our daily treatment regime for most of our patients. And then some of the outpatient trials were involved with the oral agents that are now available now. So, you know, having more tools to be able to use to treat these patients in a multidisciplinary fashion, and I think, is making a difference.
And are you seeing less use of ECMO and less people being considered for transplant as a result of COVID because of these therapies?
We're seeing less intubated and less hospitalized patients and those who have been vaccinated. But unfortunately, we're still seeing, last week we had close to 260 patients that were hospitalized. Today it's less, it's like close to 204. And they're mainly people that are unvaccinated or are under-vaccinated. The group of, that's about 70-75%. The remainder are people that basically are immune suppressed because of either solid tumor transplantation or cancer treatment or HIV disease that still, you know, it's ravaging when they get COVID.
So I wanted to switch gears a little bit and stick with COPD. I know, and maybe sometimes underappreciated, the role of the pulmonary vasculature in these patients and some oxygen therapy at times. But I know you've written in the Blue Journal several years ago on this topic. What would be some good takeaways about the role of the pulmonary vasculature and the role of supplemental oxygen in these patients with COPD?
So that's a good question. I think it's both how it affects development of emphysema and also how it affects our approach to treatment of patients with selective therapies. In terms of development, the agenesis may be an important factor to the development of emphysema. And in some cases, that's borne out by patients that have angiitis from either talc injection in the past or Ritalin, and then end up with more severe emphysema, mainly in a panacinar kind of formation. More subtle forms of that it happens with smoke exposure. It's less well detailed or environmental indolence, but probably still plays a role in those. I think one of the lessons that we've learned with surgical resection for cancer or with treatment with lung volume reduction surgery or even bronchoscopic lung reduction is the importance of the pulmonary vasculature in choosing sites that are really high highest degrees of dead space, are the areas that will most likely improve the outcomes post-intervention, whether it's lung cancer resection or it's a lung reduction procedure of any form. So identifying the pulmonary vasculature and treating that is important. In terms of supplemental oxygen, I think one of the lessons that we've learned is that in patients that are normoxic or only desaturate with exertion, that the use of long-term oxygen therapy has much less role to play than what we thought before. And that's based on the NHLBI long-term oxygen treatment trial. Then in that patient group, the use of supplemental oxygen doesn't afford any protection event about hospitalization and or death, or doesn't really improve patients' quality of life. So the use of that therapy in that patient population is really at the difference of where the patient believes the value of that therapy is. If it alleviates their symptoms, then I think it has a role. If it doesn't, trying to be dogmatic and say a patient has to use that therapy to improve their outcome, it really doesn't have a role in that patient group.
Getting back to COVID for a second, I know many major medical centers are seeing a lot of the what we call the chronic COVID, post-COVID, long haulers. Does Temple have a clinic per se to address this? And what are some of your thoughts about these patients who are developing chronic symptoms, whether it's dyspnea, fatigue, whether or not they have CT findings or not on scanning?
Yeah. So we follow long COVID as it affects the lung and pulmonary vasculature. The other parts of it, neurologic or general kind of like non-pulmonary, are followed by different parts of the health system. But in terms of long pulmonary COVID, it's as what you would expect, as was seen with SARS-1. It's people that were sicker in the hospitalized, usually the sickest of the group hospitalized, just like any other form of ARDS. Those patients are the ones that have a longer course and have more devastating consequence. Fortunately, it's the minority of the patients, probably less than 4% of the patient group that we see that has that. Some of the features of that, it's kind of spread. Some patients will have evidence of fibrotic lung disease. Some of those go on to transplant. Some of the patients that we have transplanted are people that we had in before vaccinations were prevalent, who had underlying lung involvement from scleroderma or IPF or hypersensitivity pneumonitis with some degree of fibrosis. And then after they had were infected with COVID, they had escalation and rapid progression of fibrotic phase of that disease. We don't see that so much in the vaccinated population right now. And then other forms of long COVID we've seen in the non-vaccinated population that still exists right now is more of a small airways disease, a bronchiolitis that can persist like any other viral infection. That tends to have more of a long-lasting impact for patients, at least in my anecdotal personal experience. That can last 8 to 12 months, and there might be some residual of that. How common of that? I don't really know, because fortunately, it's infrequent that we see. I think some of the NIH-sponsored long COVID trials might be able to show that with the deep phenotyping that's being done.
Well, I know, as I mentioned earlier, and you mentioned earlier, there's a lot of research going on in COPD and lung disease, and a lot of it's being done at Temple. Can you just touch on what some specific trials you're doing now at Temple with regard to the COPD patients?
Yeah, there's a couple of different buckets. We have really it's a exacerbation bucket with the pharmacologic trials that we're doing, using a range of different monoclonal antibodies for treatment. And then trying to do a pragmatic trial with looking at roflumilast versus azithromycin in people that have been hospitalized for an exacerbation to see what might be a better agent choice for individual patients. So it's those exacerbation trials. And then looking at patients with, you know, who have more frequent or severe exacerbation, looking at total lung denervation and see what the impact of that is. We are the leading U.S. center for that. And that hopefully will be a promising area since it's a different treatment paradigm than what we've used before for COPD. And then we have some of the interventional trials for chronic bronchitis, both rhinoplasty and metered dose cryospray that we're currently doing now for patients who have mucus hypersecretion with chronic bronchitis. So that's some of the trials that we have currently right now for COPD.
Very good. Well, you certainly have covered the scope of COPD therapy as well as the unfortunate situation with COVID in centers like yourself. So I want to thank you for taking the time today. Any last comments you would like to share? I mean, you've been very informative. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much. No, I'm good. Thank you.
Thanks again to Dr. Kreiner for sharing his invaluable knowledge on COPD. We're excited to see how he and his peers continue to advance our understanding and capability in treating this greatly affecting disease. If you enjoyed this interview, check out other chronic respiratory disease episodes like our interstitial lung disease discussion with Dr. Marilyn Glassberg and our review of asthma biologic therapy with Dr. Mario Castro. For additional news and insights into respiratory health, be sure to visit us at hcplive.com and lung.org. Until next month, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters, so just take it one breath at a time.